This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Tom McLeod, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 20th of January, these are our main stories. State media in China has been urging people not to panic following the announcement that a new respiratory virus is spreading across the country. The British Prime Minister has told African leaders that his country offers more than any other as it steps up its search for new markets. Also in this podcast, Africa's richest woman, Isabel dos Santos, tells the BBC that she is the victim of a politically motivated witch hunt by the Angolan government.
This is political persecution. President João Lourenço is fighting for absolute power. The fight is, who will be the candidate for the presidency of the MPLA in 2020?
We start this podcast in China, where the government has been telling its people not to panic as a new respiratory illness continues to spread. Officials have said that this strain of the coronavirus, first detected last month, has now been diagnosed in 217 people across the country, most of them in the eastern city of Wuhan. Three deaths have been linked to the outbreak, and cases have now been found in Japan, Thailand, and South Korea. Wang Linfa is the director of the Emerging Infectious Diseases Program in Singapore, and he's just been to Wuhan.
The question is it become significant human-to-human transmission or still limited? So far, all the human cases can be traced back to Wuhan. So in the next few weeks, and it's unfortunately the Chinese New Year is coming this Friday and Saturday, so there will be 400 million people on the move in China. Everybody's nervous. We need to watch the space, basically.
Well, our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell told me how the authorities have responded to the spread of the virus.
Lots more people are being sort of monitored because they've got symptoms which could be like the coronavirus. I should add that some people have been discharged, at least dozens. Three people, though, have died. And the thing that's been troubling for the authorities, though, is that it's now spread from Wuhan to other cities. So we've had two cases in Beijing, one confirmed case in Guangdong, and now a third country also. So as well as Thailand, Japan, we now have South Korea. All those people, though, seem to have come from Wuhan. And so what the scientists are asking themselves is, how easily can this virus actually jump from person to person? Initially, the thinking was maybe it's come from animals at a seafood market, which also has other types of animals, but it doesn't so easily go from person to person. And in fact, the World Health Organization, in its latest statement, has said that it looks like an animal source seems to be the most likely primary source, with, in the words of the WHO, some limited human-to-human transmission. Between close contacts, I should add. So nevertheless, they're not taking any chances because millions of people are moving around China and overseas as we speak because of the New Year celebrations. And so we've got all these new screening setups which have been put in place at big train stations and also at airports. And in fact, some flights as they arrive, medical teams are boarding the flights from Wuhan and screening every single passenger on board that flight before they let them into the terminal.
Stephen, just briefly, the state media telling people not to panic. What is broadly the reaction of the public in China, if you can tell?
Yeah, well, we actually went down and spoke to some people going into Beijing station who are travelling and wondering if they were worried about it. I have to say most people didn't seem too concerned. I think they believe that the Chinese government has learnt the lessons of SARS when there was a cover-up leading to some 700-plus dead and 8,000 people infected, and that at the moment that they think the authorities are telling the truth about the numbers as best they know. I suppose they're thinking it's not so bad at this stage. But, you know, every outbreak has to start from somewhere, and the hope is that it can't easily be transferred from person to person, or that the authorities can screen it out when they find people who are travelling who have a fever or something like that.
Stephen McDonnell with that update. But what exactly is a coronavirus? I found out from our health reporter, Michelle Roberts, who also explained what can be done to contain it.
it's a family of viruses. They come in lots of different types. Some of them infect animals, other ones can infect people too. This one at the moment seems to be a bit more than a mild cold, but we don't know how severe this is. The concern is that it could become something a bit like SARS. I don't know if you remember a few years ago, we had an outbreak of this severe acute respiratory syndrome, and that did have quite a high death rate.
You mentioned SARS. Will authorities have learned anything from how they dealt with that to how they might deal with this?
Absolutely. I mean, people are always on the lookout for what is the next big virus, trying to stop anything that could cause harm. Prevention is really difficult. Obviously, you can try and protect yourself. You know, coughs and sneezes spread diseases. That's what we've all been taught, and it's true. So cough or sneeze into a tissue, throw it away, wash your hands. If you've been touching things, if you've been in crowded spaces, clean your hands, don't touch your eyes, don't put your hands in your mouth. I mean, they might go down the route of closing schools, you know, having restrictions on different things.
Because you can't cure it. There's no injection that you can get to prevent you getting this. Is that right?
No, I mean, with these types of viruses, they can change and mutate. So you may look at it in the lab, figure out what it is, but then further down the line, it may acquire new changes, which is a challenge in terms of getting things like a vaccine or anything else that could fight it. But certainly in this situation so far, the people who have died from this, it's only a few, thankfully. And those people have been quite elderly or sick. And we have to get it in context, because if you think about common flu, that kills lots of people every year. So personally, I would at the moment be far more worried about flu than coronavirus from elsewhere. But it is obviously something that needs close monitoring and checking how this evolves.
Michelle Roberts speaking to me there. Let's turn our attention to the UK. The British government is trying to promote the country as the investment partner of choice for Africa at a summit in London today. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is hosting this gathering of African leaders in which he hopes to sell his vision of a global Britain.
We want to build a new future as a global free trading nation. That's what we're doing now. That's what we'll be embarking on the 31st of January of this month. But I want to intensify and expand that trade in ways that go far beyond what we sell you or you sell us. We want to go far beyond that. Though I have just told President Museveni of Uganda that his beef cattle will have an honoured place on the tables of post-Brexit Britain.
For more on the detail of the UK's plans, here's our correspondent Anne Soy from outside the summit venue.
More than a dozen African countries are represented here. Their leaders are attending this summit. And it's a new strategy for the UK. So we all know that UK aid has been going to Africa for many, many years. It's been focusing on the softer investments in health, education, things that change people's lives, but you can't really see. They're not very visual, the results. Unlike the Chinese, who are coming in to build the ports and the railways and the roads. And this is the focus that the UK now wants to take. So the traditional aid will continue, but some of that money will also go to back investment. And they are backing investment from the startups all the way to also investing in big businesses and a focus also to infrastructure. So they're doing a 360 kind of investment in the different sectors in Africa.
It could be big opportunities for some of those African countries, of course, but for the UK, is there a sense at the summit that this will plug the gap of any investment lost by leaving the European Union?
Certainly, and Africa is becoming a more and more important market, not just for the UK. In the past, we have had other summits where African leaders have been invited to China, to Tokyo, recently to Russia. And so there's increasing interest in investing in Africa. And when you look at Africa, the demographics, it has the youngest population in the world. It is a fast-growing population. By the year 2050, a quarter of the world's population will live in Africa. That means a quarter of the consumers. And the economies of many African countries are also some of the fastest growing in the world. And that means in the future, they will have a higher purchasing power. And therefore, hence the great interest in investing on the continent. However, there are also impediments. The key one is corruption. The systems are set such that bribes are paid, and this is something that the UK has been very vocal about. They are very much against. Their investment comes with values, and this is the pitch that Boris Johnson and his government have been making to African leaders.
That was Anne Soy. Now, a BBC investigation has seen documents that show how Africa's richest woman made her fortune through exploiting her own country and corruption. Isabel dos Santos is a fabulously successful entrepreneur and the daughter of the man who ruled Angola for four decades. But since her father stepped down as president 2 years ago, she's faced a growing chorus of criticism, including allegations of corruption. She insists that she's a victim of a witch hunt and of a vicious power struggle within Angola's governing party, the MPLA. She spoke to our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding and began by responding to allegations made by Angolan prosecutors who ordered the freezing of her business empire as part of a multi-billion dollar corruption investigation.
Well, these are false allegations, and this is part of an orchestrated attack by the current government that is completely politically motivated. It's completely unfounded. My holdings are commercial. There are no proceeds from contracts or public contracts or money that has been deviated from public funds.
Why do we have to take your word for that? This is, after all, a country in which you built up what you say is a legitimate business empire. Are we supposed to believe that overnight, suddenly, when your father moves out of power, suddenly it's a banana republic that can't be trusted to
Well, I didn't use that word. I said, you're the one using that word. What I said clearly is that this is political persecution. President John Lorenzo is fighting for absolute power. The fight is, who will be the candidate for the presidency of the MPLA in 2020? And if a different candidate would appear, or a challenger would appear, and that challenger would be supported by former President Dos Santos or people, allies linked to former President Dos Santos, that would really challenge President Lorenzo's position. And the reason why that be so is because his economic track record is very, very poor. And President Lorenzo is concerned that voices will rise and feel that he may not be the right candidate for the presidency of 2021.
So this is a pure power grab by the president, you say, right now.
Yes.
There is a pattern, though, that has been pointed out by many people, and you're aware of this, that because you were the president's daughter, a president who was in power for 38 years, you seem to have benefited.
Look, I regret that Angola has chosen this path. I think that we all stand a lot to lose. Now, when you look at my track record and you see the work I have done and you look at all the companies I've built, most certainly my companies are commercial companies. You know, if you tell me, is there anything wrong for an Angolan person to have a business venture with a state company? I think there's nothing wrong. So you have to understand that you cannot just say, because you're someone's child, you're immediately guilty.
But because
there's a lot
you're
of
somebody's no, child, you have to be careful.
Well,
and the
absolutely.
Suspicion is that you have not been, that
no, well,
you've
that's
laid yourself
untrue.
Open
that's
to these charges.
Well, that's untrue. That's untrue. It is convenient to think that if you come from a certain background and you come from a certain privilege, then an idea can be formed of you. Well, I'm asymmetric. I'm not what you would expect. You know, I'm not that box. I'm someone completely different.
And your father played no role, and the state
in
played
my business,
no role in your success.
In my business? No. I really do work in the private sector. Like
and
I said, I'm just a businessman.
How angry people feel when they hear you say that you can't take responsibility for growing up and succeeding in a kleptocracy, as they see it, like Angola, where
the
president for 40 years held so much power.
Put it this way. The people that you're referring to are voices that come from political opposition. And I think political opposition, like anywhere in the world, will try and portray a certain picture of certain people.
Isabel dos Santos speaking there to our Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding. Still to come in this podcast, the liberal lawyer Alan Dershowitz explains why he is defending Donald Trump in his Senate impeachment trial.
Even if the president did everything he was charged with in the two accusations, that would not rise to the level of an impeachable offense.
And how to take care of the lions living on the edge of the Serengeti National Park. They've attacked humans and cattle and have to be rehomed. Next, more than a year after Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou was arrested in Canada on a US warrant, a Vancouver court is about to begin formal extradition proceedings. Meng Wanzhou, who is the chief financial operator of the Chinese tech giant, is wanted by the US for Huawei's alleged violation of sanctions against Iran. Canada has faced considerable diplomatic blowback. China blocked some agricultural imports and arrested two Canadian citizens on what the Ottawa-based government says are false espionage charges. Jatinder Sidhu reports from Vancouver.
I'm peering in through the glass windows of Vancouver's Law Courts complex. They're housed in a monumental modernist building of giant concentric concrete squares with a vast sloping glass roof on one side, on which, at the moment, there's quite a lot of snow sliding down. In this complex, a judge sitting in the BC Supreme Court will decide on whether or not Meng Wanzhou should be extradited to the US.
Previously on Sanctioned. A routine flight from Hong Kong to Vancouver leads to the arrest of a global telecommunications titan. Meng Wanzhou is accused of violating U.S. sanctions against Iran.
That's a documentary series from the CBC, Canada's public broadcaster. I've come to CBC's Vancouver offices to speak to the reporter who probably knows more about this story than anyone else, Jason Proctor.
Meng Wanzhou is accused of lying to banks, and in turn, the banks made decisions which put them allegedly at risk of violating those same U.S. economic sanctions. The argument against extradition would be that the crime she's alleged to have committed in the U.S. would not be considered a crime in Canada because we don't have those same economic sanctions. And there's also an argument that's being made that her rights were violated from the moment she landed in Canada, when the Canadian Border Services agents detained her for about 3 hours before she was actually arrested, that they violated her rights by kind of conspiring with the FBI. There's also an argument that she's being used as a political pawn by U.S. President Donald Trump in order to get a better trade deal with China.
Huawei spokesman Benjamin Howes is scathing about the treatment of Meng Wanzhou.
The approach the Trump government has taken with the extradition order is a blatant abuse of process. You don't tell someone you're being stopped for a regular customs check when that's not true. You don't seize their devices and search them to try to find something juicy. And you don't treat another country like they did with Canada. We don't blame Canada for the misdeeds and abuses of the Trump administration.
And what about the two Canadians, Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig, arrested exactly a week after Meng Wanzhou?
The connection between the two Canadians and Ms. Meng has nothing to do with Huawei. We do not play a role in that. It's not for us to get involved.
Ottawa sees it very differently, however. The arrest of the Canadians was retaliation. And in what some saw as a sign of desperation, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau asked Donald Trump to stall a potential U.S.-China trade deal. Speaking in French, he said the U.S. should not sign a final agreement with China that does not settle the question of Meng Wanzhou and the two Canadians. But Huawei remains a big stumbling block. Canada is caught up in a global argument over the company's 5G network equipment. It's claimed that China could gain backdoor access to critical infrastructure. The UK, several members of the EU, and Canada say they can manage the risk. On the other hand, the US, Japan, and some other countries have banned Huawei technology.
China doesn't need Huawei to spy on Western countries. China's quite good at spying on Western countries without the help of Huawei. My name is Stephanie Carvin, and I'm an assistant professor at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University, and I'm a former national security analyst with the Government of Canada. This does seem to be about how Western democracies are dealing with state-championed companies from authoritarian regimes that may have more nefarious purposes in mind in the long run. It will say it's following the law in your country, but if you do something it doesn't like, China will take hostages on behalf of that company. So it's finding new ways to circumvent the law. So the risk here is much greater than just the technical risk. There's a much greater, larger national security issue here.
The hearings are expected to take up to 5 days, with a judgment not expected for several weeks. If the judge rejects the extradition request, or if Meng Wanzhou wins a separate challenge, she will be able to come back home. Whatever happens, this is just the end of the beginning.
Jatinder Sidhu reporting. Now, millions of Tanzanians will not be able to use their mobile phones later today when their SIM cards are deactivated. This is part of a government move to get all mobile phone users to register with a new biometric system by the end of today. The BBC's Sami Awami reports from Dar es Salaam.
For weeks, there have been long queues outside the offices of the National Identification Authority as Tanzanians try to register on the new system and avoid losing use of their phones. But with the deadline looming, close to 20 million SIM cards hadn't been registered on the new biometric database. On average, one phone user has three SIM cards. Many have criticised the government for not allowing enough time to complete the registration. But the telecoms regulator behind the process blamed people for waiting until the last minute to complete the registration. In Tanzania, phones aren't just about communication. They now carry out more financial transactions than the banks, meaning any switch off has economic implications too. The government claims that registration is about controlling cybercrime and fraud, but critics fear it will allow the authorities to eavesdrop on citizens, particularly during elections.
That was Sami Awami reporting, and we're going to stay in Tanzania next, where 36 lions living on the edge of the Serengeti National Park are to be relocated following attacks on humans and cattle. 11 of the lions have already been captured and will be rehomed at a national park some 650 kilometres away. 9 others are to join them, and an alternative location is yet to be found for the remaining lions. My colleague Alan Kasuja spoke to Will Travers, the co-founder of the Born Free Foundation, about the impact that that move might have on the lions.
There is a large group of lions, a pride of lions, or maybe it's more than one, that live around the Serengeti in Tanzania, and that they have been cattle raiding and raiding livestock. And also, I believe some people have lost their lives as well, for which obviously everyone has huge sympathy. The proposal is that they're going to be caught and moved in two groups to at least one of them, the larger group, to a place called Barigi Chato National Park, which is a new national park in Tanzania up in the northwest of the country.
Is that how to fix the problem, to move the lions from one park to another across the country?
I'm not sure that it is. It is highly controversial to move prides of lions. So, for example, if you move them into a place where lions already live, it's very likely that they will either displace those lions by killing them, or they will be in themselves killed or injured. So a lot of stress and a lot of strife can result from this. And also, I think you have to look back to where they came from and ask yourself, what were the circumstances which compelled these lions to raid cattle and raid livestock and to kill people in the first place, and to see whether every possible conflict mitigation, as we call it, has been tried, tested, and has failed, because moving lions probably is the option of last resort.
Are you saying that there might have been a problem at Serengeti? So problems like acquisition of food, perhaps?
Well, it could be that they've been persecuted for attacking livestock. It could be that more people have moved into the periphery around the park. Obviously, there's no fixed settlements inside Serengeti itself. In Kenya, which is just over the border, and I've only returned from there 48 hours ago, we've been building what we call predator-proof bomas. Now, a boma is a circle of thorns in which both people and livestock live at night, and they're fairly easily breached by large predators like lions. So we've been reinforcing them and redesigning them with the local people. And we've now built nearly 290 of these reinforced bomas. And so far, the predation on livestock inside the boma has been zero.
So over what period of time?
We've been building them since 2009.
And you say that has reduced the predation?
It has. Obviously not predation on livestock outside of the boma, which is a nighttime corral for livestock. But it's part of finding humane solutions where people benefit, where livestock is protected, and where lions aren't persecuted.
Is that lion pursued by many people? Because, you see, I imagine, coming from Uganda myself, I've always said that you have to give the people who live around the parks a stake so that they can actually be at the forefront of that interaction between humans and animals and hopefully come up with the solutions that are required in the process of conserving everybody's interest?
Well, yes. And I think if you look at the amount of revenue that, say, Tanzania, Kenya, and indeed Uganda raise from wildlife tourism, I think perhaps this isn't explained properly to local people because they can't see a direct correlation. But the amount of revenue raised in those three countries from wildlife-based tourism runs into billions of US dollars a year, and it employs millions of people.
Will Travers speaking there to Alan Kasuja. To end this podcast, let's look ahead to the impeachment trial of President Trump, which starts on Tuesday. The president's high-profile legal team has certainly sparked plenty of comment in the US media, with liberal lawyer Alan Dershowitz one of the members of his defense team. His previous clients include O.J. Simpson, Mike Tyson, and the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. He spoke to the BBC's Justin Webb and explained why he's defending President Trump.
I'm taking it on because I think the Constitution is being abused by the Democrats. I am a Democrat. I'm a liberal Democrat. I voted against Donald Trump. But I think that the Constitution intended impeachment only in extreme cases and not to be weaponized for political purposes. I'm very worried about the precedent that would be caused if this president were removed for allegations such as abuse of power or obstruction of Congress, which are not in the Constitution. And I think that the arguments, the constitutional arguments against impeachment have to be made in the Senate, and I want to see them made on a nonpartisan basis. There's been too much partisanship, and I think the Senate, hearing from a Democrat and a liberal that this impeachment should not go forward to removal, it would be good for the country.
But you're not arguing then that Mr. Trump did not do the things he's accused of. You're simply saying these things that he's accused of are themselves not violations of the Constitution. Is that right?
I wish more Americans understood that. You're absolutely right. That's precisely my point. This would be as if this were a criminal case, which I'm used to arguing, and the issue was whether or not the indictment charged a crime, not whether or not the person did it or didn't do it. So you're absolutely right. I think even if the president did everything he was charged with in the two accusations, that would not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. It wouldn't be treason, it wouldn't be bribery, and it wouldn't be a high crime or a high misdemeanor.
Do you agree with those who say that this case now completely hinges on whether or not witnesses are called in the Senate?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that it's unlikely that any witness would change the mind of any senator. First of all, the most important witnesses are likely not going to be able to testify, even if witnesses are called. For example, John Bolton, he was the national security advisor, and his conversations with the president would be covered by executive privilege. And the president would invoke executive privilege, and then the issue would have to go to the courts, and it would delay the trial for weeks, certainly months. And in the end, I don't think Bolton would be allowed to testify, because it's a paradigmatic instance of executive privilege when a president tells his national security advisor in the Oval Office.
So even if there were to be testimony at this trial, you think it's almost impossible then that that testimony would lead to any decision other than an acquittal?
I think that's probably right, unless if there were testimony that would, you know, demonstrate bribery. I don't see that that would happen. Moreover, it wasn't charged. If there was testimony that was new and dramatic, I think constitutionally you'd have to go back to the House first, and they would have to charge it.
So to many American people, well, many people around the world, this whole thing's a bit of a farce, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a farce. I think people seriously and genuinely believe that this president did impeachable things. And I think the country is deeply, deeply divided. I just think it's a mistake. I think it's a mistake for the Democrats. I think this has helped Trump, not hurt his electoral chances. Impeachment was not intended to be along party lines. Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, said the greatest danger would be for impeachment to turn on who had the most votes in the House or the Senate. And that looks like it's the way it's going to turn out.
Do you believe that Donald Trump's a good president? And would you be proud of keeping him in office and possibly having him reelected?
it's a very, very different issue. I'm a Democrat. I intend to vote Democrat. I think that Democrats would be disappointed to see the president reelected, and Republicans would be pleased. And
I was wondering about your personal feelings as someone who is a Democrat and a liberal Democrat. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. you assist now in allowing Donald Trump to have what he would paint as a triumph in the Senate and get acquitted and possibly then reelected, how would you feel about it?
Well, it creates ambivalence in me, as it does whenever I represent somebody whose acquittal would produce results that would make me unhappy as an individual. But I would never, ever allow my own partisan views to impact my views on the Constitution. I hated President Nixon, and when he was impeached, I supported his impeachment. But I actually, as a member of the National Board of the American Civil Liberties Union, urged them not to take a position on his impeachment, but rather to defend his civil liberties and constitutional rights. I took the same position with President Clinton, and I would have taken the same position had Hillary Clinton been elected, somebody I voted for, and had she been impeached. So I'm not going to allow my partisan personal views to impact my constitutional views and what I think is best for the long-term survival of the Constitution rather than the short-term partisan advantage of getting my person elected to be president.
The lawyer Alan Dershowitz speaking to Justin Webb. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can, of course, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Tom McLeod. Until next time, goodbye.
What if you could get a piece of advice from one of your heroes?
It's really nice to be able to talk to the man who cut the cord off the telephone.
What would it be?
You don't have to know what you want to do, but just don't let anyone tell you that you can't do something.
And how would it make you feel?
I don't think I've had anybody say that to me, like, just to keep pushing. And it's really great to hear that.
In our new podcast, Worldwide Web, teenagers like me get to spend time with technological innovators who have already changed the world.
I'm just somebody who is in the right place at the right time and asking the right questions, that's all.
That's Worldwide Web from the BBC World Service.
You got to make it happen for yourself. Yeah, you can't just wait for it to happen to you. Grab it. Go for it.
Search for Worldwide Web wherever you get your podcasts.
I will never forget what he said.